It must be difficult being a Soviet ace. If Monia was surprised by Polyakov's sudden statement, he didn't show it. My power is just another tool to be used against the imperialists. I'm sure that's what your superiors would like to think. God forbid you should use it for yourself. Polyakov sat down again. This time he poured himself a glass of water. He held out the bottle to Monia, who shook his head. You must be tired of the jokes by now. Water and electricity? Yes, Monia said tiredly. I have to be careful when it rains. I can't take baths. The only water I like is snow. Given the number of people who know about me, it's amazing how many jokes I've heard. They have your family, don't they? Don't answer. It's not something I know. It's just the only way to control you. The wild card virus was relatively dissipated by the time it reached the Soviet Union, but it was still strong enough to create jokers and aces, and to cause the creation of a secret state commission to deal with the problem. In typical Stalinist fashion, aces were segregated from the population and educated in special camps. Jokers simply disappeared. In many ways, it was worse than the purge, which Polyakov had seen as a teenager. In the 30s, the knock on the door came for party members, those with incorrect ambitions. But everyone was at risk during the wild card purge. Even those in the Kremlin. Even those at the very highest levels. I knew someone like you, Monia. I used to work for him. Not far from here, as a matter of fact. For the first time, Monia dropped his guard. He was genuinely curious. Is the legend true? Which legend? That Comrade Stalin was a joker and died with a stake driven through his heart? Or that it was Lysenko who had been affected? Polyakov could tell that Monia knew them all. I must say I'm shocked to think that such fabrications are circulated by officers of military intelligence. I was thinking of the legend that there was nothing left of Stalin to bury, that the corpse displayed at the funeral was made up by the same geniuses who maintain Lenin's. Very close, Polyakov thought. What did Monia know? You're a war hero, Monia. Yet you ran from that building in Berlin like a raw recruit. Why? This was another one of the old tricks, the sudden segue back to more immediate business. As Monia replied that he didn't honestly remember running, Polyakov went around the table and, sliding a chair closer, sat down right next to him. They were so close that Polyakov could smell the soap and, under that, the sweat and something that might have been ozone. Can you tell when someone is an ace? Finally, Monia was getting nervous. Not without some demonstration, no. Polyakov lowered his voice and jabbed a finger at the hero's medal on Monia's chest. What do you think now? Monia's face flushed, and tears formed in his eyes. One gloved hand slapped Polyakov's away. It only lasted an instant. I was burning up. Within seconds, yes. Burnt meat. You're the one. There was as much fascination, after all they had a lot in common, as fear in Monia's face. That was another one of the legends, that there was a second ace. But you were supposed to be in the party hierarchy, one of Brezhnev's people. Polyakov shrugged. The second ace belongs to no one. He's very careful about that. His loyalty is to the Soviet Union, to Soviet ideals and potential, not the pitiful reality. He remained close to Monia. And now you know my secret. One ace to another. What do you have to tell me? It was good to leave the aquarium. Years of institutional hatred had imbued the place with an almost physical barrier, like an electrical charge that repelled all enemies, especially the KGB. Polyakov should have been feeling elated. He had gotten some very important information out of Molnia. Even Molnia himself did not know how important. No one knew why the Hartman kidnapping had fallen apart. But what had happened to Molnia could best be explained by the presence of a secret ace, one with the power to control men's actions. Molnia could not know, of course, that something much like this had happened in Syria. But Polyakov had seen that report. Polyakov was afraid he knew the answer. The man who might very well be the next president of the United States was an ace. 2.
The chairman will see you now.
To Polyakov's surprise, the receptionist was a young woman of striking beauty, a blonde straight out of an American movie. Gone was Seryagin, Andropov's old gatekeeper, a man with the physical appearance of a hatchet, appropriately enough, and a personality to match. Seryagin was perfectly capable of letting a Politburo member cool his heels for eternity in this outer office, or if necessary, physically ejecting anyone foolish enough to make an unexpected call on the chairman of the Committee for State Security, the chief of the KGB. Polyakov imagined that this lissome woman was potentially just as lethal as Seryagin. Nevertheless, the whole idea struck him as ludicrous. An attempt to put a smile on the face of the tiger. Meet your new caring Kremlin, today's friendly KGB. Seryagin was gone, but then so was Andropov, and Polyakov himself was no longer welcome on the top floor, not without the chairman's invitation. The chairman rose from his desk to kiss him, interrupting Polyakov's salute.
Georgi Vladimirovich, how nice to see you.
He was directed to a couch, another new addition, some kind of conversational nook in the formerly Spartan office.
You're not often seen in these parts.
By your choice, Polyakov wanted to say. My duties have kept me away.
Of course, the rigors of fieldwork.
The chairman, who like most KGB chiefs since Stalin's day was essentially a party political appointee, had served the KGB as a snitch, a stukach, not an operative or analyst. In this, he was the perfect leader of an organization consisting of a million stukachi.
Tell me about your visit to the aquarium.
Quickly to business. Another sign of the Gorbachev style. Polyakov was thorough to the point of tedium in his replay of the interrogation, with one significant omission. He counted on the chairman's famous impatience and wasn't disappointed.
These operational details are all well and good, Georgi Vladimirovich, but wasted on poor bureaucrats, hmm?
A self-deprecating smile.
Did the GRU give you full and complete cooperation, as directed by the General Secretary?
Yes. Alas, Polyakov said, earning the chairman's equally famous laugh.
Do you have enough information to salvage our European operations?
Yes.
How will you proceed? I understand that the German networks are being rolled up. Every day Aeroflot brings our agents back to us.
Those not held for trial in the West, yes, Polyakov said.
Berlin is a wasteland for us now. Most of Germany is barren, and will be for years. Carthage.
But we have other assets.
Deep cover assets that have not been utilized in years. I propose to activate one known as the Dancer.
The chairman drew out a pen and made a note to have the Dancer file brought up from the registry. He nodded.
How much time will this recovery take, in your honest estimation?
At least 2 years. The chairman's gaze drifted off.
Which brings me to a question of my own, Polyakov persisted.
My retirement.
Yes, your retirement.
The chairman sighed.
I think the only course is to bring Yurchenko in on this as soon as possible, since he'll be the one who has to finish the job.
Unless I postpone my retirement. Polyakov had said the unspeakable. He watched the chairman make an unaccustomed search for an unprogrammed response.
Well, that would be a problem, wouldn't it? All the papers have been signed, Yurchenko's promotion is already approved, You will be promoted to general and will receive your third hero's medal. We're prepared to announce it at the plenum next month. The chairman leaned forward.
Is it money, Georgi Vladimirovich? I shouldn't mention this, but there is often a pension bonus for extremely valuable service.
It wasn't going to work. The chairman might be a political hack, but he was not without his skills. He had been ordered to clean house at the KGB, and clean house he would. Right now he feared Gorbachev more than he feared an old spy.
Polyakov sighed. I only want to finish my job. If that is not the desire of the party, I will retire as agreed.
The chairman had been anticipating a fight and was relieved to have won so quickly.
I understand the difficulty of your situation, Georgi Vladimirovich. We all know your tenacity. We don't have enough like you. But Yurchenko is capable. After all, you trained him.
I'll brief him.
I tell you what, the chairman said. Your retirement doesn't take effect until the end of August.
My 63rd birthday.
I see no reason why we should deprive ourselves of your talents until that date.
The chairman was writing notes to himself again.
This is highly unusual, as you well know, but why don't you go with Yurchenko, Where is this dancer?
France, at the moment. Or England. The chairman was pleased.
I'm sure we can think of worse places for a business trip.
He wrote another note with his pen.
I will authorize you to accompany Yurchenko, to assist in the transition. Charming bureaucratic phrase.
Thank you.
Nonsense. You've earned it.
The chairman got up and went to the sideboard. That, at least, had not changed. He drew out a bottle of vodka that was almost empty, pouring two glasses full, which finished it.
A forbidden toast! The end of an era!
They drank. The chairman sat down again.
What will happen to Molnia? No matter how badly he bungled Berlin, he's too valuable to waste in that horrible furnace of theirs.
He is teaching tactics now, here in Moscow. In time, if he's good, they may let him return to fieldwork.
The chairman shuddered visibly.
What a mess.
His tight smile showed a pair of steel teeth.
Having a wild card working for you. I wonder, would one ever sleep?
Polyakov drained his glass.
I wouldn't.
3. Polyakov loved the English newspapers. The Sun, The Mirror, The Globe, with their screaming 3-inch headlines about the latest royal rows and their naked women, they were bread and circus rolled into one. At the moment, some MP was on trial, accused of hiring a prostitute for £50, and then, in the Sun's typically restrained words, not getting his money's worth.
It was over so fast, Tart claims.
Which was the greater sin? Polyakov wondered. A tiny deck on that same front page mentioned that the Aces Tour had arrived in London. Perhaps Polyakov's affection for the papers derived from professional appreciation. Whenever he was in the West, his legend, or cover, was that of a TASS correspondent, which had required him to master enough rudimentary journalistic skills to pass, though most Western reporters he met assumed he was a spy. He had never learned to write well, certainly not with the drunken eloquence of his Fleet Street colleagues, but he could hold his liquor, and he could find a story. At that level, at least, journalism and intelligence were not mutually exclusive. Alas, Polyakov's old haunts were unsuitable for a rendezvous with the dancer. Recognition of either of them would be disastrous for both. They could not, in fact, use a public house of any kind. To make matters worse, the dancer was an uncontrolled agent, a cooperative asset, to use Moscow Center's increasingly bland jargon. Polyakov had not even seen him in over 20 years, and that had been an accidental encounter following even more years of separation. There were no prearranged signals, no message drops, no intermediaries, no channels to let the dancer know that Polyakov had come to collect. Though the dancer's notoriety made certain kinds of contacts impossible, it made Polyakov's job easier in one respect. If he wanted to know how to find this particular asset, all he had to do was pick up a paper. His assistant and future successor, Yurchenko, was busy ingratiating himself with the London resident. Both men showed only a passing interest in Polyakov's comings and goings, joking that their soon-to-be-retired friend was spending his time with King's Cross whores. "Just to be sure you don't wind up in the newspapers, Georgi Vladimirovich," Yurchenko had teased. "If you do, at least get your money's worth," since such behavior by Polyakov was not unprecedented. Well, he had never married, and years in Germany, particularly in Hamburg, had given him a taste for pretty young mouths at affordable prices. It was also quite true that the KGB did not trust an agent who possessed no notable weakness. One vice was tolerated, so long as it was one of the controllable ones, alcohol, money, or women, rather than, say, religion. A dinosaur such as Polyakov, who had worked for Beria, for God's sake, having a taste for honey? Well, that was considered rakish, even charming. From the TASS office near Fleet, Polyakov went alone to the Grosvenor House Hotel, riding in one of the famous English black cabs. This one actually belonged to the embassy, down Park Lane to Knightsbridge to Kensington Road. It was early on a workday, and the cab crawled through a sea of vehicles and humanity. The sun was up, burning off the morning haze. It was going to be a beautiful London spring day. At Grosvenor House, Polyakov had to talk his way past several very obvious guards while noting the presence of several discreet ones. He was allowed as far as the concierge station, where he found, to his annoyance, another young woman in place of the usual old scout. This one even looked like the chairman's new gatekeeper. "Will the house telephone put me through to the floors where the Aces Tour is staying?" The concierge frowned and framed a reply. Clearly the tour's presence here was not common knowledge, but Polyakov preempted her questions, as he had gotten past the guards, by presenting his press credentials. She examined them. They were genuine in any case. Then guided him to the telephones.
"They might not be answering at this hour, but these lines are direct."
"Thank you." He waited until she had withdrawn, then asked the operator to ring through to the room number one of the embassy's footmen had already provided.
"Yes?"
Polyakov had not expected the voice to change, yet he was surprised that it had not. "It's been a long time, dancer." Polyakov was not surprised by the long silence at the other end.
"It's you, isn't it?"
He was pleased. The dancer retained enough tradecraft to keep the telephone conversations bland.
"Didn't I promise that I would give you a visit some day?
What do you want?"
"To meet. What else?"
"To see you."
"This is hardly the place."
"There's a cab waiting out front. It'll be easy to spot. It's the only one at the moment."
"I'll be down in a few minutes."
Polyakov hung up and hurried out to the cab, not forgetting to nod to the concierge again.
"Any luck?"
"Enough, thank you." He slipped into the cab and closed the door. His heart was pounding. "My God," he thought, "I'm like a teenager waiting for a girl." Before long, the door opened. Immediately, Polyakov was awash in the dancer's scent. He extended his hand in the Western fashion. "Dr. Takion, I presume?" The driver was a young Uzbek from the embassy, whose professional specialty was economic analysis, but whose greatest virtue was his ability to keep his mouth shut. His total lack of interest in Polyakov's activities and the challenge of navigating London's busy streets allowed Polyakov and Takion some privacy. Polyakov's wild card had no face, so he had never been suspected of being an ace or joker. That, and the fact that he had only used his powers twice.
The first time was in the long, brutal winter of 1946 to 47, the winter following the release of the virus. Polyakov was a senior lieutenant then, having spent the Great Patriotic War as a zampolit, or political officer, at the munitions factories in the Urals. When the Nazis surrendered, Moscow Center assigned him to the counterinsurgency forces fighting Ukrainian nationalists, the men from the forests who had fought with the Nazis and had no intentions of giving up. In fact, they continued fighting until 1952. Polyakov's boss there was a thug named Suvin, who confessed drunkenly one night that he had been an executioner in the Lubyanka during the purge. Suvin had developed a real taste for torture. Polyakov wondered if that was the only possible response to a job that daily required one to shoot a fellow party member in the back of the neck. One evening, Polyakov brought in a Ukrainian teenager, a boy, for questioning. Suvin had been drinking and began to beat a confession out of the kid, which was a waste of time. The boy had already confessed to stealing food. But Suvin wanted to link him to the rebels. Polyakov remembered mostly that he had been tired. Like everyone in the Soviet Union in that year, including those at the very highest levels, he was often hungry. It was the fatigue, he thought shamefully now, not human compassion, that made him leap at Suvin and shove him aside. Suvin turned on him and they fought. From underneath the other man, Polyakov managed to get his hands on his throat. There was no chance he could choke him, yet Suvin suddenly turned red, dangerously red, and literally burst into flames. The young prisoner was unconscious and knew nothing. Since fatalities in the war zone were routinely ascribed to enemy action, the bully Suvin was officially reported to have died heroically of extreme thoracic trauma and burns, euphemisms for being fried to a cinder. The incident terrified Polyakov. At first, he didn't even realize what had happened. Information on the wildcard virus was restricted, but eventually he realized that he had a power, that he was an ace, and he swore never to use the power again. He had only broken that promise once. By the autumn of 1955, Georgi Vladimirovich Polyakov, now a captain in the organs, was using the legend of a junior TASS reporter in West Berlin. Aces and jokers were much in the news in those days. The TASS men monitored the Washington hearings with horror. It reminded some of them of the purge and delight. The mighty American aces were being neutralized by their own countrymen. It was known that some aces and their Takesian puppet master, as Pravda described him, had fled the U.S. following the first HUAC hearings. They became high-priority targets for the Eighth Directorate, the KGB department responsible for Western Europe. Takion, in particular, was a personal target for Polyakov. Perhaps the Takesian held some clue to the secret of the wildcard virus. Something to explain it. Something to make it go away. When he heard that the Takesian was on the skids in Hamburg, he was off. Since Polyakov had made prior research trips to Hamburg's red light district, he knew which brothels were likely to cater to an unusual client such as Takion. He found the alien in the third establishment he tried. It was near dawn. The Takesian was drunk, passed out, and out of money. Takion should have been grateful. The Germans as a race had little liking for drunken indigents. Masters of Hamburg whorehouses had even less. Takion would have been lucky to have been dumped in the canal, alive. Polyakov had taken him to a safe house in East Berlin, where after a prolonged argument among the residenti, he was supplied with controlled amounts of alcohol and women while he slowly regained his health, and while Polyakov and at least a dozen others questioned him. Even Shelyapin himself took time out from his plotting back in Moscow to visit. Within 3 weeks, it was clear that Takion had nothing left to give. More likely, Polyakov suspected, that Takesian had regained sufficient strength to withstand any further interrogation. Nevertheless, he had supplied them with so much data on the American aces, on Takesian history and science, and on the wildcard virus itself,
that Polyakov half expected his superiors to give the alien a medal and a pension. They did almost as much. Like the German rocket engineers captured after the war, Tachyon's ultimate fate was to be quietly repatriated, in this case to West Berlin. They transferred Polyakov to the illegal's residence there at the same time, hoping for residual contacts and allowing both men a simultaneous introduction to the city. Because of East Berlin, they would never be friends. Because of their time in the Western sector, they could never be total enemies. In 40 years on this world, I've learned to alter my expectations every day, Tachyon told him. I honestly thought you were dead.
Soon enough I will be, Polyakov said.
But you look better now than you did in Berlin. The years truly pass slowly for your kind.
Too slowly at times.
They rode in silence for a while, each pretending to enjoy the scenery, while each ordered his memories of the other.
Why are you here? Tachyon asked.
To collect on a debt.
Tachyon nodded slightly, a gesture that showed how thoroughly assimilated he had become.
That's what I thought.
You knew it would happen one day?
Of course. Please don't misunderstand. My people honor their commitments. You saved my life.
You have a right to anything I can give you.
Then he smiled tightly. This one time.
How close are you to Senator Greg Hartman?
He's a senior member of this tour, so I've had some contact with him. Obviously not much lately, following that terrible business in Berlin.
What do you think of him, as a man?
I don't know him well enough to judge. He's a politician, and as a rule I despise politicians. In that sense he strikes me as the best of a bad lot. He seems to be genuine in his support for jokers, for example. This is probably not an issue in your country, but it's a very emotional one in America, comparable to abortion rights. He paused. I doubt very much he would be susceptible to any kind of arrangement, if that's what you're asking.
I see you've taken up reading spy novels, Polyakov said. I'm more interested in, let's call it, a political analysis. Is it possible that he will become president of the United States?
Very possible. Reagan has been crippled by his current crisis and is not, in my judgment, a well man. He has no obvious successor, and the American economy is likely to worsen before the election. The first piece of the puzzle. There is one American politician who has left in his wake a series of mysterious deaths worthy of Beria or Stalin. The second, the same politician is kidnapped twice and escapes under mysterious circumstances twice. The Democrats have several candidates, none without major weaknesses. Hart is sure to eliminate himself. Biden, Dukakis, any of the others could disappear tomorrow. If Hartman can put together a strong organization, and if the right opening occurs, he could win. A recent Moscow Center briefing had predicted that Dole would be the next U.S. president. Strategists at the American Institute were already creating an expert psychological model of the senator from Kansas. But these were the same analysts who predicted Ford over Carter and Carter over Reagan. On the principle that events never turn out the way experts say, Polyakov was inclined to believe Tachyon. Even the theoretical possibility of a Hartman presidency was important, if he was an ace. He needed to be watched, stopped if necessary, but Moscow Center would never authorize such a move, especially if it contradicted its expensive little studies. The driver, by prearrangement, headed back toward Grosvenor House. The rest of the trip was spent in reminiscence of the two Berlins, even of Hamburg.
You aren't satisfied, are you? Tachyon said finally.
You want more from me than a superficial political analysis, surely.
You know the answer to that.
I have no secret documents to give you. I'm hardly inconspicuous enough to work as a spy.
You have your powers, Tachyon.
And my limitations. You know what I will and will not do,
I'm not your enemy, Tachyon. I'm the only one who even remembers your debt. And in August, I'll be retired. At this point, I'm just an old man trying to put together the pieces of a puzzle.
Then tell me about your puzzle. You know better than that.
Then how can I possibly help you?
Polyakov didn't answer.
You're afraid that by even asking me a direct question, I'll learn too much.
Russians.
For a moment, Polyakov wished for a wild card power that would let him read minds. Tachyon had many human characteristics, but he was Takesian. All of Polyakov's years of training did not help him decide whether or not he was lying. Must he depend on Takesian honor?
The cab pulled up to the curb, and the driver opened the door, but Tachyon didn't get out.
What's going to happen to you?
What indeed, Polyakov thought.
I'm going to become an honored pensioner, like Khrushchev, able to go to the front of a queue, spending my days reading and reliving my exploits over a bottle of vodka for men who will not believe them.
Tachyon hesitated.
For years I hated you. Not for exploiting my weakness, but for saving my life. I was in Hamburg because I wanted to die. But now, finally, I have something to live for. It's only been very recent, so I am grateful, you know.
Then he got out of the cab and slammed the door.
I'll see you again, he said, hoping for a denial.
Yes, Polyakov said. You will. The driver pulled away.
In the rearview mirror, Polyakov saw that the Takesian watched them drive off before going into his hotel. No doubt he wondered where and when Polyakov would turn up again. Polyakov wondered, too. He was all alone now, mocked by his colleagues, discarded by the party, loyal to some ideal that he only barely remembered. Like poor Molnia, in a way, sent out on some misguided mission and then abandoned. The fate of a Soviet ace is to be betrayed. He was scheduled to remain in London for several weeks yet, but if he could no longer extract useful information from a relatively cooperative source, such as the dancer, there was no point in staying. That night he packed for the return to Moscow and his retirement. After a dinner, in which he was joined only by a bottle of Stolichnaya, Polyakov left the hotel and took a walk, down Sloane, past the fashionable boutiques.
What did they call the young women who shopped here? Yes, Sloane Rangers.
The Rangers, to judge from the stray samples still hurrying home at this hour, or from the bizarre mannequins in the windows, were thin, wraith-like creatures. Too fragile for Polyakov. In any case, his ultimate destination, his farewell to London and the West, was King's Cross, where the women were more substantial. On reaching Pont Street, however, he noticed an off-duty black cab following him. In moments he considered possible assailants, ranging from renegade American agents to Light of Allah terrorists to English hoodlums, until he read in the reflection from a shop window the license number of a vehicle belonging to the Soviet embassy. Further examination revealed that the driver was Yurchenko. Polyakov dropped his evasions and simply met the car. In the back was a man he didn't know.
"Georgi Vladimirovich!" Yurchenko shouted. "Get in!"
"There's no need to yell," Polyakov said. "You'll draw attention."
Yurchenko was one of those polished young men for whom tradecraft came so easily that, unless reminded, he often neglected to use it. As soon as Polyakov was aboard in the front seat, the car jumped into traffic. They were quite obviously going for a ride.
"We thought we were losing you," Yurchenko said pleasantly.
"What's this all about?" Polyakov said. He indicated the silent man in the back seat. "Who's your friend?"
"This is Dolgov of the GRU. He's presented me with some very disturbing news."
For the first time in years, Polyakov felt real fear. Was this to be his retirement? An accidental death in a foreign country? "Don't keep me in suspense, Yurchenko. The last time I checked, I was still your boss.
Yurchenko couldn't look at him.
That the Kizhin is a double agent. He's working for the Americans and has for 30 years.
Polyakov turned toward the GRU man.
So now the GRU is sharing its precious intelligence? What a great day for the Soviet Union. I suppose I'm suspected of being an agent.
The GRU man spoke for the first time. What did the Takishin give you?
I'm not talking to you. What my agents give me is KGB business.
The GRU will share with you, then. Takion has a grandson named Blaise, whom he found in Paris last month. Blaise is a new kind of ace, potentially the most powerful and dangerous in the world, and he was snatched right out of our hands to be taken to America.
The car was crossing Lambeth Bridge, heading toward a gray and depressing industrial district, a perfect location for a safe house, the perfect setting for an execution.
Takion had a grandson with powers. Suppose this child came into contact with Hartman. The potential was horrifying.
Life in a world threatened by nuclear destruction was safe compared to one dominated by a wild-card Ronald Reagan.
How could he have been so stupid?
I didn't know, he said finally. Dancer was not an active agent. There was no reason to place him under surveillance.
But there was, Dolgov persisted. He's a goddamned alien, for one thing. And if his presence on the tour itself wasn't enough, there was the situation in Paris.
It was easy for the GRU to spy on someone in Paris. The embassy there was full of its operatives. Of course, the sister service hadn't bothered to pass its vital information along to the KGB. Polyakov would have acted differently with Monia had he known about Blaze. Now he needed time to think. He realized he had been holding his breath, a bad habit.
This is serious. We should obviously be working together. I'm ready to do whatever I can.
Then why are you packed?
Yurchenko interrupted, sounding genuinely anguished.
You've been watching me?
He looked from Yurchenko to Dolgov. My God, they actually thought he was going to defect.
Polyakov turned slightly, his hand brushing Yurchenko, who recoiled as if slapped. But Polyakov didn't let go.
The cab sideswiped a parked car and skidded back into traffic, just as Polyakov saw Yurchenko's eyes roll up. The heat had already boiled his brain.
Dolgov threw himself into the front seat, grabbing for the wheel, and managed to steer right into another parked car where they stopped. Polyakov had braced for the impact, which threw Yurchenko's smoking body off him, freeing him to reach out for Dolgov, who made the mistake of grabbing back.
For an instant, Dolgov's face was the face of the great leader, the benevolent father of the Soviet people, himself turned into a murderous joker.
Polyakov was just a young courier who carried messages between the Kremlin and Stalin's dacha, sufficiently trusted that he was allowed to know the secret of great Stalin's curse. Not an assassin. He had never intended to be an assassin. But Stalin had already ordered the execution of all wildcards. If it was his destiny to carry this power, it must also be his destiny to use it. As he had eliminated Stalin, so he eliminated Dolgov. He didn't allow the man to say a word, not even the final gesture of defiance, as he burned the life out of him. The impact had jammed the two front doors, so Polyakov would have to crawl out the back. Before he did, he removed the silencer and the heavy service revolver Dolgov carried, the weapon he was to have pressed to the back of Polyakov's neck. Polyakov fired a round into the air, then put the revolver back where Dolgov carried it. Scotland Yard and the GRU could think what they liked. Another unsolved murder, with the murderers themselves the victims of an unlucky accident. The fire from the two bodies reached the tiny trickle of gasoline spilled in the crash. The crematorium would not get Dolgov. The explosion and flames would attract attention. Polyakov knew he should go.
Yet there was something attractive in the flames. As if an aged, dutiful KGB colonel were dying too, to be reborn as a superhero. The one true Soviet ace. This would be a legend of his own creation. 4. There were many signs in Russian at the British Airways terminal at Robert Tomlin International Airport, placed there by members of Jewish Relief, headquartered in nearby Brighton Beach. For Jews who managed to emigrate from the Eastern Bloc, even those who dreamed of eventually settling in Palestine, this was their Ellis Island. Among those debarking this day in May was a stocky man in his early 60s, dressed like a typical middle-class émigré, in brown shirt buttoned to the neck and well-worn gray jacket. A woman from Relief stepped forward to help him.
«Здравствуйте, с союзом статом», she said in Russian. «Welcome to the United States».
«Thank you», the man replied in English. The woman was pleased.
«If you already speak the language, you will find things very easy here. May I help you?»
«No, I know what I'm doing». Out there in the city waited Dr. Takian, living in fear of their next encounter, wondering what it would mean to his very special grandson. To the South, Washington, and Senator Hartman, a formidable target. But Polyakov would not work alone. No sooner had he gone underground in England than he had managed to contact the shattered remains of Molniya's network. Next week, Gimli would be joining him in America. As he waited for customs to clear his meager luggage, Polyakov could see through the windows that it was a beautiful American summer day.
From the Journal of Xavier Desmond. April 27th, somewhere over the Atlantic. The interior lights were turned out several hours ago, and most of my fellow travelers are long asleep, but the pain has kept me awake. I've taken some pills, and they are helping, but still, I cannot sleep. Nonetheless, I feel curiously elated, almost serene. The end of my journey is near, in both the larger and smaller senses. I've come a long way, yes, and for once, I feel good about it. We still have one more stop, a brief sojourn in Canada. Whirlwind visits to Montreal and Toronto, a government reception in Ottawa, and then home. Tomlin International, Manhattan, Jokertown. It will be good to see the funhouse again. I wish I could say that the tour had accomplished everything we set out to do, but that's scarcely the case. We began well, perhaps, but the violence in Syria, West Germany, and France undid our unspoken dream of making the public forget the carnage of Wildcard Day. I can only hope that the majority will realize that terrorism is a bleak and ugly part of the world we live in, that it would exist with or without the wildcard. The bloodbath in Berlin was instigated by a group that included jokers, aces, and gnats. And we would do well to remember that, and remind the world of it forcefully. To lay that carnage at the door of Gimli and his pathetic followers, or the two fugitive aces still being sought by the German police, is to play into the hands of men like Leo Barnett and the Nur al-Allah. Even if the Tukesians never brought their curse to us, the world would have no shortage of desperate, insane, and evil men. For me, there's a grim irony in the fact that it was Greg's courage and compassion that put his life at risk, and hatred that saved him. By turning his captors against each other in that fratricidal holocaust. Truly, this is a strange world. I pray that we have seen the last of Gimli, but meanwhile I can rejoice. After Syria, it seems unlikely that anyone could still doubt Greg Hartman's coolness under fire. But, if that was indeed the case, Surely all such fears have now been firmly laid to rest by Berlin. After Sarah Morgenstern's exclusive interview was published in the Post, I understand Hartman shot up 10 points in the polls. He's almost neck and neck with Hart now. The feeling aboard the plane is that Greg is definitely going to run. I said as much to Digger back in Dublin over a Guinness and some fine Irish soda bread in our hotel, and he agreed. In fact, he went further and predicted that Hartman would get the nomination. I wasn't quite so certain and reminded him that Gary Hart still seems a formidable obstacle. But Downs grinned in that maddeningly cryptic way of his beneath his broken nose and said, "Yeah, well, I got this hunch that Gary's going to fuck up and do something really stupid. Don't ask me why. If my health permits, I will do everything I can to rally Jokertown behind a Hartman candidacy. I don't think I'm alone in my commitment either. After the things we've seen, both at home and abroad, a growing number of prominent aces and jokers are likely to throw their weight behind the senator. Hiram Worcester, Peregrine, Mistral, Father Squid, Jack Braun, perhaps even Dr. Tachyon, despite his notorious distaste for politics and politicians. Terrorism and bloodshed notwithstanding, I do believe we accomplished some good on this journey. Our report will open some official eyes, I can only hope, and the press spotlight that is shown on us everywhere has greatly increased public awareness of the plight of jokers in the Third World. On a more personal level, Jack Braun did much to redeem himself and even buried his 30-year enmity with Tachyon. Perry seems positively radiant in her pregnancy, and we did manage, however belatedly, to free poor Jeremiah Strauss from 20 years of simian bondage. I remember Strauss from the old days, when Angela owned the funhouse, and I was only the maitre d', and I offered him a booking if and when he resumes his theatrical career as the projectionist. He was appreciative, but noncommittal. I don't envy him his period of adjustment. For all practical purposes, he's a time traveler. And Dr. Tachyon, well, his new punk haircut is ugly in the extreme. He still favors his wounded leg, and by now the entire plane knows of his sexual dysfunction. But none of this seems to bother him since young Blaze came aboard in France. Tachyon has been evasive about the boy in his public statements, but of course, everyone knows the truth. The years he spent in Paris are scarcely a state secret, and if the boy's hair was not a sufficient clue, his mind control power makes his lineage abundantly clear. Blaze is a strange child. He seemed a little awed by the jokers when he first joined us, particularly Chrysalis, whose transparent skin clearly fascinated him. On the other hand, he has all the natural cruelty of an unschooled child, and believe me, any joker knows how cruel a child can be. One day in London, Tachyon got a phone call and had to leave for a few hours. While he was gone, Blaze grew bored, and to amuse himself, he seized control of Mordecai Jones and made him climb onto a table and recite "I'm a Little Teapot," which Blaze had just learned as part of an English lesson. The table collapsed under the hammer's weight, and I don't think Jones is likely to forget the humiliation. He didn't much like Dr. Tachyon to begin with. Of course, not everyone will look back on this tour fondly. The trip was very hard on a number of us. There's no gainsaying that. Sarah Morgenstern has filed several major stories and done some of the best writing of her career. But nonetheless, the woman is edgier and more neurotic with every passing day. As for her colleagues in the back of the plane, Josh McCoy seems alternately madly in love with Peregrine and absolutely furious with her. and it cannot be easy for him with the whole world knowing that he is not the father of her child. Meanwhile, Digger's profile will never be the same. Downs is at least as irrepressible as he is irresponsible. Just the other day, he was telling Tachyon that if he got an exclusive on Blaze, maybe he would be able to keep Tach's impotence off the record. This gambit was not well received. Digger has also been thick as thieves with Chrysalis of late. I overheard them having a very curious conversation in the bar one night in London. "I know he is," Digger was saying. Chrysalis told him that knowing it and proving it were two different things. Digger said something about how they smelled different to him, how he'd known ever since they met. And Chrysalis just laughed and said that was fine, but smells that no one else could detect weren't much good as proof. And even if they were, he'd have to blow his own cover to go public. They were still going at it when I left the bar. I think even Chrysalis will be delighted to return to Jokertown. Clearly, she loved England, but given her Anglophile tendencies, that was hardly a surprise. There was one tense moment when she was introduced to Churchill during a reception, and he gruffly inquired as to exactly what she was trying to prove with her affected British accent. It is quite difficult to read expressions on her unique features, but for a moment I was sure she was going to kill the old man right there in front of the Queen, Prime Minister, and a dozen British aces. Thankfully, she gritted her teeth and put it down to Lord Winston's advanced age. Even when he was younger, he was never precisely reticent about expressing his thoughts. Hiram Morchester has perhaps suffered more on this trip than any of us. Whatever reserves of strength were left to him burned out in Germany, and since then he has seemed exhausted. He shattered his special custom seat as we were leaving Paris, some sort of miscalculation with his gravity control, I believe, but it delayed us nearly 3 hours while repairs were made. His temper has been fraying, too. During the business with the seat, Billy Ray made one too many fat jokes, and Hiram finally snapped and turned on him in a white rage, calling him, among other things, an incompetent little gutter mouth. That was all it took. Carnifex just grinned that ugly little grin of his, said, "For that, you get your ass kicked, fat man," and started to get out of his seat. "I didn't say you could get up," Hiram replied. He made a fist and trebled Billy's weight, slamming him right back into the seat cushion. Billy was still straining to get up, and Hiram was making him heavier and heavier, and I don't know where it might have ended if Dr. Tachyon hadn't broken it up by putting both of them to sleep with his mind control. I don't know whether to be disgusted or amused when I see these world-famous aces squabbling like petty children. But Hiram, at least, has the excuse of ill health. He looks terrible these days. White-faced, puffy, perspiring, short of breath. He has a huge, hideous scab on his neck, just below the collar line, that he picks at when he thinks no one is watching. I would strongly advise him to seek out medical attention, but he is so surly of late that I doubt my counsel would be welcomed. His short visits to New York during the tour always seemed to do him a world of good, however, so we can only hope that homecoming restores his health and spirits. And lastly, me. Observing and commenting on my fellow travelers and what they've gained or lost, that's the easy part. Summing up my own experience is harder. I'm older and I hope wiser than when we left Tomlin International. And undeniably, I am 5 months closer to death. whether this journal is published or not after my passing, Mr. Ackroyd assures me that he will personally deliver copies to my grandchildren and do everything in his power to make sure that they are read. So, perhaps it is to them that I write these last concluding words. To them and all the others like them. Robert, Cassie, we never met, you and I. And the blame for that falls as much on me as on your mother and your grandmother. If you wonder why, remember what I wrote about self-loathing, and please understand that I was not exempt. Don't think too harshly of me, or of your mother or grandmother. Joanna was far too young to understand what was happening when her daddy changed. And as for Mary, we loved each other once, and I cannot go to my grave hating her. The truth is, had our roles been reversed, I might well have done the same thing. We're all only human, and we do the best we can with the hand that fate has dealt us. Your grandfather was a joker, yes. But I hope as you read this book, you'll realize that he was something else as well. That he accomplished a few things, spoke up for his people, did some good. The JADL is perhaps as good a legacy as most men leave behind them. A better monument to my mind than the pyramids, the Taj Mahal, or Jet Boy's tomb. All in all, I haven't done so badly. I'll leave behind some friends who loved me, many treasured memories, much unfinished business. I've wet my foot in the Ganges, heard Big Ben sound the hour, and walked on the Great Wall of China. I've seen my daughter born and held her in my arms, and I've dined with aces and TV stars, with presidents and kings. Most important, I think I leave the world a slightly better place for my having been in it, and that's really all that can be asked of any of us. Remember me to your children, if you will. My name was Xavier Desmond, and I was a man. From the New York Times, July 17, 1987. Xavier Desmond, the founder and president emeritus of the Joker's Anti-Defamation League, JADL, and a community leader among the victims of the wildcard virus for more than 2 decades, died yesterday at the Blythe Van Rensselaer Memorial Clinic after a long illness. Desmond, who was popularly known as the mayor of Jokertown, was the owner of the Funhouse, a well-known Bowery night spot. He began his political activities in 1964, when he founded the JADL to combat prejudice against wildcard victims and promote community education about the virus and its effects. In time, the JADL became the nation's largest and most influential Joker rights organization, and Desmond, the most widely respected Joker spokesman. He sat on several mayor's advisory committees, served as a delegate on the recent global tour sponsored by the World Health Organization. Although he stepped down as president of the JADL in 1984, citing age and ill health, he continued to influence the organization's policies until his death. He is survived by his former wife, Mary Radford Desmond, his daughter, Mrs. Joanna Horton, and his grandchildren, Robert Van Ness and Cassandra Horton. Shuffling the Deck, or Book 4 and the World Tour, by George R. R. Martin. Here there be spoilers. You do not want to read what follows until after you've finished Aces Abroad and the 3 books before it. Wild Cards began with a 3-book contract, but the series was always intended to be open-ended. So, when the first 3 volumes were published to excellent reviews and very strong sales, and Bantam asked me for more, my writers and I were pleased to oblige. We loved this world and the characters who peopled it, and knew we had many more stories to tell about them. The question was, where should we go from here? Joker's Wild had brought the first triad to a climactic close. The astronomer was dead. His Egyptian Freemasons smashed and dispersed, and out in the dark of space, the swarm had been tamed and turned away from Earth. But our characters remained, and damn few of them had been left to live happily ever after. Yeoman was still on the streets with his bow, fighting his one-man war against the Shadow Fist. Croyd Crenson still woke, transformed every time he surrendered to sleep. James Spector remained on the loose, his eyes brimming with death. The great and powerful Turtle had been killed in Joker's Wild, or had he? Was the Turtle sighting that evening authentic? Just what had happened to Tom Tutbury after the astronomer's minions had sent his shell crashing into the Hudson? And we had larger issues to deal with as well. We'd had some fun pitting our aces against the menace of the swarm and the evil of the astronomer, but we were plowing ground that had been plowed 1,000 times before. Aliens and supervillains had been staples of the funny books since the first one came rolling off the press. Our versions had been grittier and more visceral, perhaps, but there was nothing really new in those types of adventures. The most widely acclaimed story in the first three books had been Walter John Williams' Nebula finalist, Witness, a powerful tale of human frailty where the villain was neither the swarm nor the astronomer, but rather the House of Un-American Activities Committee. A few of our readers seemed to think that Walter made up HUAC, but never mind. There was a lesson there, if we wanted Wild Cards to be all that it could be. Plenty of comic books featured superheroes fighting supervillains and alien invasions, but very few seriously explored the deeper issues that would arise if a handful of superhumans had powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. The responsibilities and temptations of great power randomly bestowed, the ways society would deal with those who were more than human, and with the new underclass, the Jokers. Aces as objects of hero worship, and aces as objects of fear. The cult of the celebrity. All this should be grist for our mill, and the thematic heart and soul of Wild Cards. We also wanted to broaden our canvas. The first triad had been very tightly focused on New York City. Oh, we got some glimpses of what was happening in the rest of the world during the Swarm War, and earlier as well, when the four aces were chasing Perón from Argentina and losing China to the communists. But that was all they were. Glimpses. For the most part, our eyes remained fixed on the towers of Manhattan and the mean streets of Jokertown. It was time we showed what the Dickensian virus had done to the rest of the world. In my afterword to the iBooks edition of Joker's Wild, I talked about my belief that the most effective shared worlds were those that maximize the sharing. That was a lesson that carried over into the second triad. We wanted a series where the whole was always greater than the sum of its parts. I had been fortunate enough to assemble the most gifted group of writers ever to work together on a collaborative project of this nature. And in the first three books, they had given us a richly textured world with its own history, full of fascinating characters and conflicts. But to build on that foundation, we needed to start working together more closely than we had previously. I wanted to draw our plot threads together and make the second Wild Cards triad much more tightly woven than the first. In later years, much of the planning for the Wild Cards books would be done online, in a private category on the Genie BBS service. But back then, the series and the internet were both still in their infancy. Instead, the New Mexico Wild Cards contingent assembled in the living room of Melinda Snodgrass's old house on 2nd Street, where we argued over coffee and, from time to time, phoned up some of our out-of-town contributors to draw them into the dialogue as well. As with the earlier triad, we decided that the first two volumes would feature a series of individual stories linked by an interstitial narrative, while the third and concluding volume would bring everything together in a full mosaic novel along the lines of Joker's Wild. The astronomer and his Masonic cult had been the major overarching threat in the first three books. In this new triad, that role would be filled by Senator Greg Hartman, a wonderfully complex character who showed a noble, idealistic face to the world as he led the fight for Joker rights, while concealing the sadistic ace puppet man within him. Hartman's 1976 bid for presidency had failed in book one, but there was no reason not to try again. The Hartman story would be the major unifying thread of these next three books, the overplot, we called it. But there would be other conflicts going on as well. Both John Miller and Leanne Harper had given us a glimpse into New York's criminal underworld, and it seemed inevitable that John's Asian mob and Leanne's old-line mafia family would come into conflict. So, that became a second major plot thread, the focus of the middle book of this triad, Volume 5 in the overall series, which would eventually be titled Down and Dirty. The fourth book, the one you've just finished, would be built around a global junket led by Senator Hartman, its stated purpose to investigate the impact of the wildcard virus on other parts of the world. That would serve to reintroduce Hartman and Puppet Man and get the overplot rolling, while simultaneously allowing us to tell some stories we would never have been able to tell had the series remained tightly based in New York City. Of course, it wasn't that simple. With wildcards, nothing ever was. I have sometimes likened wildcards to a big band or symphony, but writers are not accustomed to following a conductor. In this band, sometimes two people would leap in to play the same solo, determined to drown each other out. At other times, while most of the band was attempting Beethoven's Fifth, there would be one oboe off in the corner, stubbornly playing Mozart instead, and another guy on the harmonica doing the theme song to My Mother the Car. As editor, sometimes I felt as if I were herding cats, big cats, and me, with neither a chair nor a whip, though I did have a checkbook, which works better than a whip on writers. The triad, which began with Aces Abroad, was indeed much more tightly plotted than the first, though not nearly as tightly as some of the later triads would be. Wildcards was more interwoven than any shared world series that preceded it, or that followed it, for that matter. But that meant we were exploring virgin territory, so none of us really knew the way. No, not even your humble editor, though editors are usually infallible, as is well known. Looking back on Aces Abroad all these years later, I think that perhaps I should have cracked my checkbook whip a little more often at several points in the proceedings. Having Hartman kidnapped twice during the same tour was a bit much, really, and I should have insisted that my writers juggle with the balls they already had up in the air before allowing them to toss up so many new ones. It is all very well when the plot thickens, but if it gets too bloody thick, you're likely to throw your wrist out stirring. Still, it all worked out in the end, more or less. And if perhaps there were too many new characters being introduced, well, many of them would go on to greatly enrich the series in later books. It was here we first met the Living Gods and Team Malice. Here that Mackie Messer first cut a bloody path into our hearts, Hear that the Hero Twins and the Black Dog and Dr. Tachyon's darling grandson Blaze made their debuts, and Kahina and the Nuralala as well. Polyakov came on stage for the first time, as did Ed Bryant's Aboriginal shaman, Wayangare. Though the new character, destined to play the largest role down the line, was not actually new at all. That was Jerry Strauss, introduced in the first book as the projectionist before becoming a great ape for a decade and a half. It was only after he was restored to humanity in Aces Abroad that our readers, like Dr. Tachyon, found themselves slapping their heads and remembering that the wild card never affects animals. As the projectionist and the great ape, Jerry was just a bit player. But later, as nobody, he would become somebody, so to speak. Aces Abroad was a book for goodbyes as well. Lou Scheiner's heroic pimp, Fortunato, had been a wild card's mainstay since the first volume. In those early days, he was one of our two most popular characters, judging from the mail we got and what our readers told us at conventions. Dr. Tachyon was the only character to equal Fortunato's popularity, but the readers who loved Tack inevitably hated Fortunato and vice versa. The wimp and the pimp dichotomy, we called it. Lou had sent Fortunato off to Japan after his climactic battle with the astronomer in Joker's Wild to give the character some closure. But Gail Gerstner Miller threw him a curveball when she had Peregrine turn up pregnant by Fortunato. And then we brought the tour to Japan, right to his doorstep. That managed to coax one last Fortunato story out of Lou. After which, the pimp shuffled permanently off stage, leaving the wimp to reign in solitary splendor for a time. Aces Abroad also marked the end for my own Xavier Desmond, the mayor of Jokertown, whose voice I used for the interstitial narrative. Writing the interstitial segments was always one of the most challenging assignments in doing a wild cards book. Not only did you need to tell a good story of your own, you also had to tie together all the other stories, bridge any gaps your fellow writers might have left, and patch up holes in the overplot. Later in the series, I would farm out the interstitials to various other brave souls, but in the beginning I did them all myself. The Journal of Xavier Desmond was the best of my interstitials, I think, and one of the most powerful things I ever wrote for Wildcards. All in all, the second Wildcards triad got off to a flying start when our aces and jokers boarded the stacked deck for their trip around the world, little realizing what storms lay ahead for the characters, writers, and editor alike. The madness that was down and dirty, and the monstrous runaway growth of Book 6. But those are tales for another day. George R. R. Martin, January the 2nd, 2002. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Wild Cards 4, Aces Abroad, edited by George R. R. Martin. This program was directed by Fred Sanders, executive producer Janet Stark. Text copyright 1988 by George R. R. Martin and the Wild Cards Trust. Expanded edition copyright 2014, George R. R. Martin and the Wild Cards Trust. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.